Radio City, back at it. John Grayson, Rob Ross, after a time away. And thank you for holding out and waiting for us to come back. So here we are. And Rob Ross, how's everything in New York?
Well, you know New York. It's awful. I mean, this place is just terrible. It's a horrible city, and it's just getting worse. And the only solace I find in any of this is that, you know, I'm getting much older, so I won't be around to see it actually sink into the ground.
When it finally collapses, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's really no way to spin it in a positive sense, because there's nothing redeeming about New York anymore. You know, but a lot has been going on. The last time we got together, I believe it was, and I apologize if I get this wrong, September?
Yes.
You were just about to have your surgery.
And I did.
So let's talk about you first, and then we'll get to me, because I've had both good and bad. So we'll talk about that in greater depth later. But I kind of know what's been happening with you, because obviously John and I talk, you know, folks, off, you know, air on a regular basis. So I do know what's going on. But, you know, to fill in the blanks, since September, and it's been a while, and it's been nothing but good things, I want to let John have his moment of letting you know how things have unfolded.
Yeah, and it was interesting. I mean, for folks who have, you know, maybe just forgotten or just, you know, are now joining us after all this time, I had weight loss surgery. And we went into some of the reasons for that and the details on it on the last show. So if you want to know that and you didn't listen to the last show, well, then that's where all that information is. But it was what's called a gastric sleeve, which is not the most dramatic weight loss surgery. It's kind of the second one in line, because of the amount of weight that I felt like and my doctor felt like I needed to lose. So we did the surgery. Recovery was very quick. I was there in the hospital for one day, stayed overnight, and they said, okay, these are the goals that you have to hit before we let you go home. And I had hit most of them even before bed that night. So it was fine. And then, I mean, that's not to say there was no pain. There absolutely was. Like any surgery, when you have part of you cut out, there's going to be pain involved in that. I was off work for a week, then went back. Everything was fine. Everything has been fine since. No complications at all. It was exactly what they told me to expect is what has been happening. And really, the most dramatic thing about this is the weight loss itself. There was some prep that was involved that went for about a month. And during that time, I lost about 15 pounds. Since then, I have added another, let me do some quick math here, 40, almost 50 pounds in addition to that. So it's been, I'm trying to remember exactly what the numbers are. It's actually not quite that much. I think what I'm down now is almost 57 pounds. And that's since July, when all of this started, kind of the end of July when the prep started. So I'm now at right around between 210 and 211 pounds, which is just unbelievable. And they said, what's going to happen now? And they told me this was the case. That will start to slow down, that there's this immense drop off right at the beginning, and then it just sort of, it's like a curve. It just levels out, and then you lose a little bit. You lose a little bit every week, and then eventually I'll get down to my target weight, which I'm much more than halfway there, which I can't say enough about it. It was the life-changing experience that I hoped it would be. And I haven't dealt with yet, because I've been very closely monitoring and following all of my doctor's instructions. I know one of the things that a lot of people have run into after this kind of surgery is gallbladder problems, because your cholesterol takes some time to kind of work itself out. And you're eating a lot of food in the meantime that's very high in protein, which is also, unfortunately, how your body synthesizes cholesterol. And what can happen because of that is that your gallbladder, which is supposed to get rid of all of that stuff, or at least be the place where it's all kind of mitigated, it you end up with gallstones. So what my doctor did is he's had me on, I don't know that it's a statin, but it is a cholesterol drug. And it's a very low dose. It's one of those things that's just kind of a maintenance thing, just to make sure that it doesn't get out of hand. So I've had no complications with that. I've had the last time they did blood work on me, which was about a month ago, it was fine. They said the only thing that I was a little still deficient on was vitamin D. So in addition to the regular vitamins that I'm taking every day, which are, you know, bariatric vitamins, they added another vitamin D supplement. So I go back at the beginning of January for my next appointment. They'll do blood work again, make sure everything is okay, and then off we go.
First, let me just say this, especially someone who has gone through heavy duty weight loss much earlier in life and am doing so now as well, you know, I could not be more proud of you as a friend and brother. And I just so unbelievably happy for you. And you've been inspirational in my trying to lose the weight because the doctor told me I needed to. And, you know, it's a difficult thing as we get older. I mean, it's just, you know, when I was younger, I was able to drop off weight like there was no tomorrow when I finally made the conscious effort to do so. First question, though, just out of curiosity, are you on Crestor or Lipitor?
It's neither one. Like I said, I'm not sure that it's even a statin. I, you know, and honestly, I can't remember the name of the drug that I'm taking right now. I just know it's the one that I split in half and take half in the morning and half at night before I go to bed. So
interesting.
Yeah.
The reason I ask is because, of course, as we know, after I saw the doctor back in April, he put me on a very low dose of Crestor. I called him a couple of weeks ago to get the prescription refilled, and he said, I'm taking you off Crestor and putting you on Lipitor. Same low dose, he goes, but I read this study where these doctors found that there's a higher chance of Crestor causing diabetes, which I'm not sure how that works just by virtue of the fact that bringing cholesterol down helps to prevents you from, you know, possibly going towards diabetes for whatever that may be worth. But now I'm on a very low dosage of Lipitor instead.
Oh, good. So, okay. Yeah.
And since you, you know, you went on the diet and since I started the diet in April, I'm happy to say that I'm down to 189. So I guess that's a total of 17 pounds from when I started. It's a very slow go. Certainly the Thanksgiving holiday did give me a bit of a stumbling block, but nothing unmanageable.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still doing the same regimen that I did, whereas Tuesdays and Thursdays are liquid diet, you know, and like you, I take a whole host of vitamin supplements. I actually take 19 supplements those 2 days. So, and that includes vitamin D, vitamin C, saw palmetto for my prostate, fish oil, flaxseed oil, turmeric and ginger and bromelain for joints, you know, because as I've gotten older, I'm slowly developing, if I haven't already, at least some form of arthritis because I feel the pains in the joints and so on and so forth.
Sure.
I mean, this is reality. I'm going to be 59 in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
The other thing is I haven't been to the doctor since, was it July, August. I had an appointment slated for November, along with another appointment that he wanted me to have with the dermatologist because he saw a mole on my chest, which has been there for 100 years, and said, I want you to have a biopsy. I'm like, okay, no more biopsies. You know, I had one voluntarily for the things that were on my, you know, I told you about that skin condition on my hand and feet.
Yeah.
No more biopsies, but this is going to immediately lead, although I will say this much, my next doctor's appointment is my now 6 month instead of every 3 month check-in with the urologist on January, whatever the first Friday of January is. It's 2 days before my birthday, I think. So I go for the blood test on Saturday the 30th, and I go to, for my prostate check then. I haven't seen any doctor since because I finally found a new full-time job. So that
Fantastic.
Is the really big positive news. I will keep it to a minimum and say it's with a financial consulting firm that works within telecommunications and broadcasting, which is phenomenally interesting. In the short time that I've been there, first and foremost, from the day that I started, they immediately embraced me as if I'd been there all along. It's a great atmosphere with very interesting, very smart, very professional people. Younger people too, but they're all very kind, very mature, and it's so refreshing to be around good, focused people. And in the short time that I've been there, I was hired to be, you know, the general manager, the admin, the HR, you know, office manager, etc. But the boss himself said, you're more than this, and I want you on this very, very serious and important project that we have coming up. We have a deadline, and I think you're going to be perfect for this. And this Friday, when our deadline came up, we pulled it off, and I could not be more proud to have been part of that.
That's fantastic.
It's been a great experience so far. this has been the best professional experience I've had since I worked at the public relations firm back in 2007. As I always called it, my second dream job and my first real adult job, because I was already 41 at the time. But that was the really great news. Now, the only other thing that's happened since is, and I'm going to try and get through this without losing my composure, but and you know this, so please bear with me, John. Around the time that I got offered the job, we had to take my cat, Roxy, who I think everyone, especially those of you who are not just friends but fans of the show, you know how much this particular cat has meant to me. She's my love. You know, she's my baby. The bond that was between us from the moment I met her is just, it's indescribable. And it was very special. We took her into the doctor because it seemed like she had a bit of a mouth infection. The doctor extracted a few teeth, said if her lip goes back to looking normal in a couple of days, she's going to be fine, even though they had found a small mass under her tongue. They took out the teeth. He said she's going to be fine. She's not going to need any biopsy. Okay, a week later, I noticed there's blood coming out of her mouth. Mm. And we made an emergency trip to the vet, and the substitute doctor who was there this woman was the doctor who treated Bailey, my other cat, during the summer when Bailey had an upper respiratory infection. She was fantastic, and Bailey was fine within 3 to 4 days. She looks at Roxy and she says, oh, she should be fine. I'm going to give her some medication. She doesn't need any kind of biopsy or anything like that. And within a week, Roxy deteriorated and I lost her. She died on November 28th. And I have not really been myself since we lost her. It was just a devastating thing to witness. And when we took her in the night, I got home from work. Liz called me when I was on the subway and said, Roxy, I just got home and Roxy is lifeless. And I think we need to take her over to the animal hospital. I said, as soon as I get home, we'll go. You know, I tried to keep myself calm. The doctor who was attending that night was Roxy's original doctor from when we first took her. And she told us that Roxy had cancer, an aggressive form of cancer. Why didn't anybody do blood work from the outset and tell us this?
Yeah.
That's the part that I'm really still having a great deal of difficulty coming to terms with and not feeling incredibly raw about. And so I'm still incredibly angry, but suffice it to say, it was a knife just plunged into me, and she was gone within minutes from us bringing her into the vet's office. So, you know, it's been hard, but we went to the Staten Island Council for Animal Welfare, and I will say this, I miss her. I feel the void every day because from the first night we brought her in to the night before she passed away, she slept on my chest every night. I mean, this was truly my baby. And like I said, I loved her more than anything in this world. So for me, it's a loss that I just can't put into the accurate words. There are no words for it, period. But after several days, we went to the Staten Island Council of Animal Welfare. They have two rescue shelters located in a local PetSmart and on the other side of the island, a Petco. And the first day we went, none of the cats really seemed to take to us, and that was a little disappointing. We went to the Petco the next day on the Sunday, and we met this adorable little girl who started climbing all over us. Now, I think you know the caveat, you don't pick the cat picks you.
Oh, always, yeah.
Which is, I'm going to go into a side story here. When we lost my first girl, Jinx, which was as devastating a loss as you can imagine. In 2003, you know, I didn't even know what to do. And by sheer grace or happenstance, luck, whatever you want to call it, the day after we lost Jinx, we found ourselves at the PetSmart, only because we were going to Staples next door. But we went into PetSmart and thought we'd get some toys for our one remaining cat, Nibbles. We didn't know that there was a shelter there. And we went in and we started talking to the young man there. And that's how we were introduced to the group called the Staten Island Council for Animal Welfare, SICAW. And we saw a couple of cats. They didn't really take to us or anything like that. And I asked this young man who was sitting there, out of all the female cats, which one is the nicest? And he goes, without missing a beat, oh, Midnight. And I'm like, well, which one's Midnight? And the very first cage at the very top of the cage rows, I didn't see anything. And he opens the cage and goes, midnight. And out pops this adorable little black face. She kind of sniffs in the air and then jumps right into Liz's arms. And Liz cradles her like a baby. And I put my face down right by Midnight's. And as the guy is getting the words out of his mouth, I should warn you, she loves to smooch. She was licking my face furiously. And Liz just looked and said, honey, I think she's the one. And that was it. So, yeah. You know, Psycho came to the house on the Monday. I wasn't working at the time. So they came to the house. They met us. The minute they walked in, they said, Midnight's going to be so happy here. And the next day they called me and said, you can pick her up. I went to get her. I had her in the carrier on the seat next to me in the car. I had the little grate on the top open so she could stick her head out. And all she did was talk the entire way home. It was a conversation that was hysterical. And I get her home. I put the carrier down. And Nibbles is looking like, what is this? And I open up the little gate on the carrier. Midnight sticks her face out. Sniffs at Nibbles, looks at me, sniffs at Nibbles again, and then just walks right past her and climbs up onto the couch like she'd always been there.
Yeah, this is my home.
And that was what we had for 10 full years. And when we lost Midnight, part of me died inside because she was the sweetest, most loving cat you ever met. And I was not handling it well. And it was 2 hours after we lost her. And Paisley, who was our other cat, she never knew anything except for Midnight. Midnight raised her because we got Paisley the same day we met Midnight. We got Paisley in the grocery store, if you can believe that, because somebody had abandoned a bucket of newborn kittens in 100-degree heat. So we took home Paisley. And so, you know, Paisley's eyes hadn't opened, her ears hadn't popped. She was a week old when we brought her home.
Wow.
And so Midnight raised her as if it was her baby. And so, you know, Paisley suddenly very disoriented. The only thing she's ever known is gone. But 2 hours after Midnight died, I said, we're going to PetSmart. We're going to go see a cat. And my thought was get another black cat because most people don't realize it, but black cats, like senior cats, are the ones that are always left behind because of that stupid old myth about black cats being bad luck, which is absolutely
– yeah.
It's a farce because black cats are the most loving and affectionate and loyal of all of them. We walk in there and of course I'm thinking black cat, but this little tiny thing, not a kitten, but this tiny cat sticks her paws through the gate, you know, the bars on the cage and lets out this enormous yowl at us, looking right at us as if to say, pick me, I'm yours, take me home. And we couldn't take our eyes off her because she was so adorable and she was so tiny and she was so loud that she had such a personality that we said, okay, let's meet her. And the moment they opened the front of the cage, she leaped right onto me and held onto me. And I was holding her and cuddling her and kissing her. And Liz was holding her and cuddling her and kissing her like, done deal. That was it. It took all of 2 minutes. And we filled out the forms on a Saturday. You know, this was a Saturday. They came to the house Sunday afternoon. And about an hour after the woman left from the home visit, they said, you can come back to PetSmart and pick her up. They fast-tracked her for us.
That's great.
So that was Roxy. And you know, when we got her home, we brought her into the spare room so, you know, Paisley wouldn't be freaked out or anything. And, you know, Roxy was a little nervous, like as a cat would be, and she was hiding for a moment. And then I had to go to my company's holiday party, of all things. And I said, look, I'm not going to stay late. I'll be back in about 2 hours. I stayed maybe two and a half hours. I come home. Liz is sitting on the couch and Roxy's on her lap. Again, it was like, okay, this is perfect. So,
yeah.
Now we're here, and this beautiful little girl that we would love to bring home, I'm hoping will be our Christmas present. I think that would be great. You know, it may sound trite, and a couple of people – and by the way, for those of you who listened to this show and who posted messages on my Facebook page, I just want to say thank you for your very, very kind words. They were all very helpful and very meaningful and healing, and – somebody very kindly and wisely suggested, you know, adopting another, to which I say to him, sir, you could not be more correct and accurate. You know, as I said, when we lost Midnight and we brought home Roxy, the best way to honor the one that you lost is to give another little one a chance at having a life of a home and love. And that's exactly what we plan on doing. So we are going to be doing that. It's just going to take another week or so, but hopefully we will be able to bring little baby Clover home. And, you know, hope for the best. So that's where we are at now at the tail end of 2023, which has been you know, I keep saying each year, I hope it gets better. I hope it gets better. And this has got to have been one of the hardest years to kind of navigate through so many different levels, personal and just, you know, in the outer world and, you know, health and everything else that goes along with it. And sports, well, John, let's just veer to the comedy element of the show, because let me just say this much. The New York Mets couldn't have been more disappointing, but we knew that as the season began. The Jets are an atrocity. The bright spot, the New York Rangers. Even the Georgia Bulldogs managed to lose the one game that they could not afford to lose, and wound up subsequently not going to the national championship game because they lost to, of all teams, again, Alabama. Georgia's going to the Orange Bowl, but doesn't matter. They should have beaten Alabama. They should have played better. They played down to Alabama's level because Georgia dominated every single team they played throughout the season. They should have beaten Alabama handily. But the Rangers right now are tied for second place overall in the league. They're tied with the Bruins. Right now, Vegas has 45 points. Rangers and Bruins have 43. But the Rangers are playing fantastic hockey. Up-tempo, they've stumbled a couple of times in a really ugly manner, as if to say, did you even show up for the game? But otherwise, the Texas Rangers, the team that's got Jacob deGrom and Max Scherzer, won the World Series. The World Series that had the lowest ratings in years. Max Scherzer, in the times that he pitched for the Rangers during the playoffs in the World Series, I don't even think he pitched the World Series because he was hurt. He lost each game.
Yeah.
He pitched.
And they were playing Arizona. So it was like, what does anybody have to grab onto in any of those games? Because, I mean, who's the story there? You know what I mean? And it seems like every great World Series, every World Series that really has given us something to hang on to, has given us the story, whatever it is. Going all the way back, and I mean, the folks in St. Louis are going to hate me for bringing this up, but I don't bring it up because of the Cardinals. I bring it up because of the Royals. When, what was it, 95, when Saberhagen won?
85.
It was the 85. Okay, that's right. It was, the I-70 series between them and the Cardinals. And the night that he pitched the winning game in the World Series, his wife had a baby. And I mean, it was just this unbelievable story. Okay, who's the story between Texas and Arizona?
Well, you start right here. It was two wild card teams. You know, the fact that Texas had been leading the division until the very end, lost it to Houston, and just barely scraped into the playoffs. Arizona, I think, would be, if you're going to have a story, well, okay, here's the story. Texas went out and tried to buy themselves a World Series victory, which they did do, but look at what they've got. Damaged goods from the Mets, not even contributing.
Right.
So can you consider Jacob deGrom a World Series champion or Max Scherzer a World Series champion? No. And they're all this team is all over the hill, too. They're all old players. The story, I guess, would be – oh, and by the way, that's the first – championship for the long vaunted Washington Senators franchise.
Right.
That's the only other thing you can throw behind it. The Arizona Diamondbacks, who didn't spend any money because, you know, the Rangers spent enormous sums of money to get where they got. Arizona is one of the teams that you and I talked about earlier in the year, like Cincinnati, like Baltimore, and so on, that have built themselves up with no money, small markets, and played their hearts out. That's what made them the far more interesting team and made you want to root for them to begin with.
And they lost, right?
They lost. But the thing is that at least, you know, they showed me something that a lot of teams don't. I mean, they, you know, look, they went up against the Dodgers and they destroyed the Dodgers. And I mean, destroyed them the same way Atlanta had destroyed the Cardinals a couple of years ago in the playoffs. You know, when you talk about great World Series, the story of the Washington Nationals versus the Houston Astros, seven-game series, one on the road. Nobody won their home games. They won all their games on the road, and that's how the Nationals won. That was a fantastic story, you know? But regardless, it was just such an anticlimax, and here's the best postscript of all for the Texas Rangers for the upcoming season. DeGrom's going to start the season still on the disabled list because of the Tommy John surgery, right? Scherzer just had surgery. He's going to be out until at least July. Okay. This is what they traded their future for. A guy who's barely salvageable, you know? The Mets, for all of the – and I'm one of the ones, and I think you've heard me say this. I'm one of the few that said I think the Mets did the right thing even before they did pull the trigger on dumping all of those salaries and players. I said get rid of them, purge them. They're not going to get you to where you want to be. They're all going to be hurt by the time that they might be needed, you know, when it's going to count the most. And sure enough, I was right about Scherzer yet again. DeGrom was never even a thought because DeGrom was going to leave regardless. You knew he was going to opt out of his contract while he was still with the Mets, which is exactly what he did. He chose not to re-sign with them. He took the money and ran to Texas and pitched, what, a handful of games, and then he's out for the next year and a half.
Yeah.
It's his second or I think it's his second Tommy John surgery. He's 34 years old. Do you really think for one moment he's going to live up to that contract that he signed with Texas?
Oh, no, of course not. And so, yeah, like I said, it was anticlimax. The entire thing just meant absolutely nothing to me. So it doesn't surprise me to find out that it was as low rated as it was. But, we are talking tonight after the Bills just finished off the Dallas Cowboys, and I mean just torched the Dallas Dolphins, Cowboys.
I mean, I'm so glad we went out this afternoon because I did not need to sit there and watch a 31-0 demolition of the Dolphins over the Jets.
Oh, yeah.
That was just an atrocity.
Well, and the Dolphins are frauds anyway, but I mean, we'll prove that in a couple of weeks. But the thing that drives me absolutely crazy about this season is that you talk about playing down to your competition. I mean, you look at the games that the Bills have lost. Denver, New England, Chicago. I mean,
Jets.
And the Jets, right.
Although let's give that one a kind of like a question mark because it was opening night under the oddest of circumstances when your so-called savior, and I've got no beefs with Aaron Rodgers, but, you know, the savior goes down immediately on his first play.
Right.
He's out for ostensibly the season.
But what preseason looked to be the hardest stretch for the Bills all year long is the past 4 weeks, one of which was the bye week. But it was Philadelphia and Kansas City and Dallas. And what do? We won 2 out of 3 of them. But we lose to a bunch of crap teams. Chicago, by the way, was not a loss. That was a preseason win. But, I mean, just these terrible teams. Like, losing that game to the Patriots was unforgivable. But, I mean, that's division. That kind of thing can happen. Losing to Denver when they were awful? Right now the Bills are still faced with winning out, and they could win out and still miss the playoffs. So it's nobody's fault but ours. However, you've got to like, if they're able to sneak in, you've got to like their chances of being able to do some real damage during the playoffs because they're obviously peaking at exactly the right time, even in the face of all the injuries that they have. And with the Sabres, it's been, you and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that they either beat the living tar out of somebody or they get the living tar beat out of them. They're losing game 7-2, but they're winning game 7-3. You know, the only game that was close, and it wasn't even close until late, was when they beat the Bruins. And you mentioned the Bruins with the league lead right now. And what do the Sabres do? From 8th place, beat them, you know?
Well, so, last night's a perfect example. I mean, the Rangers were down 1-0 in Boston against – and here's the thing I want to say. The Rangers have done just that all season. If you look at the losses they've had for the season, they're playing against teams with the worst records. They got beaten handily by Toronto, who's not very good. They were beaten terribly, and I mean embarrassingly, by Ottawa, who are not good. If I'm not mistaken, Buffalo beat them.
Yep.
And remember, because that was when I think we did the last show, was they were about to play Buffalo that night. And I said, watch Buffalo beat the Rangers because Buffalo isn't that good at the moment, you know? But last night, they go up to Boston after taking I think it was a 7-3 drubbing at the hands of Toronto the other night in New York. And I want to say part of the problem was every one of these losses, Shesterkin's been in goal. Jonathan Quick, who is 37 years old and is the backup goalie, has won every game this season, save for the one loss in overtime against Minnesota. I think you may have seen it, where he caught the puck in the shootout and it popped up and went over his back and rolled into the net. It was a sheer accident that Minnesota, quote, got the win in the shootout.
Yeah.
But that was not – I wouldn't have called that a good goal because he caught it. It was just that it popped up and after he caught it. regardless, Quick has won every single game when he's in net. Last night, Shesterkin is in net. Rangers go to Boston. Boston scores in the first period. Third period, Vincent Trocheck ties it on a power play and then wins it in overtime in Boston. So now you've got the Rangers and the Bruins tied for certainly the East. They're only 3 points behind, 2 points behind Vegas, who have 45. And we're talking about for the overall league lead, which is a pretty good spot to be in at the moment.
Right. And with the Sabres, I mean, they're in seventh place right now because Ottawa dropped into eighth place. But the thing is, Ottawa's got seven games in hand on us. They've only played 25 games so far. The Sabres have played 32, and they're only 7 points behind. So if they halved it, you know, for those seven games, they would be tied with us. So, yeah, I don't know what to think. When the Sabres look good, they look really, really good. And that's something that I haven't been able to say for a very long time, that they've finally got some kind of solidity going. Now, all they have to do is be able to put together a couple of runs in the late part of the season, and who knows what might happen. So, I don't know. We'll keep an eye on them and see how things go. But at the moment, I mean, all eyes are on the Bills and just trying to figure out, okay, is this team going to be able to do what it takes to make it into the playoffs this year?
Which is kind of a sad state of affairs because, let's face it, it's just been overall, again, in the scope and the full view of the entire year, it's been a lousy year for sports, too. It's just been unexciting and uninspired. It's like, it's almost like everybody on the planet is still in a fog.
You know what? You're right. Well, and I want to move, if we can move away from sports and into pop culture for just a minute, because I want to talk about a couple of the people that we have lost just the last month or so, because there were two names that stuck out to me. And this is not to put their names above anybody else. I know there have been a ton of celebrities, unfortunately, that we've lost over the last little bit. But there were two men who died within the last month that meant more to my childhood and my television watching habits when I was a kid than anybody before or since. And I want to start with talking about Marty Croft, because if there was anybody who taught us how to be weird and how to be successful and make something meaningful while you were just putting together the most apparently blue-skied television ever, I don't know that Sid and Marty Croft, between the two of them, had any rivals with that. I mean, you talk about Sigmund and the Sea Monsters. You talk about the Bugaloos. You talk about certainly H.R. Puffin stuff. I mean, Lidsville, Wonderbug. You can go on and on and on about these crazy TV shows that we grew up watching, and our childhood was backdropped by cartoons on one side and Sid and Marty Croft on the other side. My conversation with Marty about 5 or 6 years ago was about, at one point we talked about the fact that they had this incredible record of having shows picked up. He pitched 20 pilots, 18 of them were picked up, 16 of them were hits. Tell me somebody in television who has a record anywhere near that.
So this is going to sound like a weird question, but did they have something to do with the creation of the banana splits, even though Hanna-Barbera
was? Oh, that was theirs,
because
too.
Because it was
their
puppets, right?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm not imagining. All I can say about the whole Sid and Marty Croft thing is you put it perfectly. It's like we had the cartoons on one side, but on the other side, basically what we had was a live, you know, live action acid trip for children.
Yes.
I mean, just H.R. Puffin stuff and Lidsville were LSD personified.
Without doubt.
And I had no idea what LSD was at the time. It's just like, all I knew was, okay, that English kid is annoying me. That does not look like a dragon. And why is Charles Nelson Reilly looking so fucking weird?
Yeah.
And that's kind of stretching it, folks, because if you knew Charles Nelson Reilly, well.
Yeah, he definitely had his own idiosyncrasies. But, I mean, those shows were so much fun. And the other thing that they did is they gave us some of the most indelible bad guys ever. I mean, you talk in the movies, you talk about like Darth Vader and Hannibal Lecter and all of these amazing bad guys that we've had on the big screen. But on the small screen, Witchy Poo, the Sleestaks, Blurp and Slurp. I mean, these terrifying images of...
Were Blurp and Slurp Sigmund's brothers?
Yes, right. Okay, and then Jesus. There was Big
that
Daddy.
That I remember and... this and that you remember this is really scaring me.
Yeah, I know. But they were absolutely incredible. And so, I mean, that's what made those shows fun. And, you know, he talked about wanting to, yes, you have to be able to scare kids. Oh, you know, but the other one was Dr. Shrinker. I don't know if you remember that one, but that didn't have any of the puppets in it. That was the bad guy who shrunk down these teenagers and was terrorizing them through the entire show, but they kind of escaped. And then, you know, it was just this weird show. And I don't even remember the name of the actor who played Dr. Shrinker, but he was also terrifying.
Lidsfield. Charles Nelson Reilly, was that the one with Butch Patrick?
I think so.
Because I know Butch Patrick was in one of these shows.
He definitely was, yeah. You
know, post-Munsters, of course.
Right.
And post The Phantom Tollbooth, which is another classic. That's a completely different realm.
And, you know, and you take that, and I mean, right on the heels of that, at age 101, we lose the man who gave us Archie Bunker.
Oh, Norman Lear.
Yeah. I mean, when Norman Lear died, it was just like, you know, again, how much of, if our childhood was Sid and Marty Krofft, our journey into adulthood was kind of guided by him.
Well, I mean, if we lived in a house like I did, where it was a fairly, and I'm going to use the word in the proper context, a progressive household, you know, because I was an only child, my parents would let me basically watch what they watched, you know, because they watched with me. So if I was watching perhaps on a, you know, Saturday morning, one of these Sid and Marty Krofft shows, you could be sure I was watching, you know, All in the Family on Saturday night, or whatever night it was on, you know.
And Maude, and, you know, on and on, The Jeffersons.
Good times, The Jeffersons. and one of my favorites, Mary Hartman.
Yes. And you know, the thing about him is that his whole deal was very, very simple. And I mean, the fact that you mentioned, you know, coming from a progressive household, and the fact that he took one of the biggest Hollywood liberals in history, in Carol O'Connor, and turned him into Archie Bunker. I mean, it was amazing, first of all, that they were able to pull that off. But then, you know, you realize that all he was doing was showing us ourselves. He showed us what life was actually. Life was never like the TV shows in the 60s and in the early part of the 70s. You know, what Norman Lear did, the avatar for that has become Archie Bunker being the first character ever to flush the toilet on TV. You know, that you heard that sound and it was like, wow, this is actually life. These are the arguments that I hear my uncles having with my father. These are the things that happen in our house.
Right.
And you think about the brilliance of that, and it seems so simple, and yet nobody did it because nobody was willing to go to bat and fight with the network censors and fight with the advertisers the way that Norman Lear did, because he had to. He knew that it would be a crime to the audience to do anything less.
Which I think the groundwork was laid by the Smothers Brothers, if you think about it.
Absolutely.
Everything that they went through, the lawsuits, the fights, and being fired, and then countersuing CBS for what CBS had done to them, along with the censors, I think CBS was cowed enough by that experience, because they were found liable for it. And so when Norman Lear came along, they gave him the leeway to do what he wound up doing, you know?
Right, right.
I mean, up until that time, you know, Sherwood Schwartz kind of ruled the roost with Pap, like, and don't get me wrong, you know, a lot of those shows we all watched, but I mean, the Brady Bunch was squeaky clean cutesy.
Of course.
So was, you know, Gilligan's Island and everything.
And the Partridge Family. And yeah, right, you could go on down the line.
Stuff. Yeah. So, you know, the closest thing you had to subversive until the Smothers Brothers may have been the Monkees, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, first of all, the improv, the in-jokes, the very obvious to us now in hindsight, in-drug jokes.
Drug humor, sure.
But also it's the fact that they were talking directly to us as equals, not talking down to us. It's not like, oh, this is a show about a cute little rock band who lived together in the beach. No, these were four long-haired weirdos struggling, you know, in the harsh face of, you know, rock stardom. Sorry, I couldn't resist saying that.
Yeah.
Because it's a think piece.
I love that, you know, movie so much.
Talking directly to the audience. I mean, I don't know of any other shows at the time that would break the fourth wall.
Yeah.
You know, cartoons did that, but you didn't realize it until much later on, you know?
Right.
Nevertheless, you know, It has been a strange time of celebrity losses because, you know, it seemed to start with the likes of, you know, well, first of all, let me go get me my Jew. Go get me Kissinger. Yeah, I just want to tell you now, I'm 105 years old, maybe 150. I'm looking like Methuselah. It's time to go. I go hang out with the big dick now.
Yeah, and he will be always, in my mind, remembered for one thing and one thing only, and that's sitting there at a Carpenters concert that was given a command performance at the White House. And who is his date for the evening? Mamie Van Doren.
Wow.
Uh-huh. Richard Carpenter.
I did not know that.
And Richard Carpenter was caught on a hot mic going, hey, who's the bombshell with Kissinger? And he was not wrong. Oh, Mamie. Oh, the dreams.
Yes, indeed. We lost Ryan O'Neill, who was a fairly good actor, but boy, what a... You know what? I'm sorry. It gets harder, especially as you get older, and I would like to think more rational, to separate the person from the actor or the talent.
Yeah.
He's just such a questionably creepy, he was an awful guy.
He always had a good deal of smarm in every single one of his portrayals.
I mean, well, if you've ever seen old reruns of Peyton Place when he played Rodney,
uh-huh.
Just the name Rodney alone says it all. Rodney Harrington, in fact, was his name. The namesake of the ever-loving Harrington jacket.
Right.
There is one, though, that's very close to my heart and very personal, and that is we also lost a very wonderful man named Scott Kempner. Scott Top Ten Kempner, who had played guitar first in the highly influential proto-punk band The Dictators, and later on the... Even though they really never claimed to have a leader, he was sort of the driving force behind the incredible Delords. Scott was a really lovely guy. I had gotten to become friends with him through Facebook, and we had a lot of good conversations and communications over the years. Some really hilarious things, like I'll never forget swapping bar mitzvah stories with him. That was one of my favorite memories because I had him in stitches over the fact that, you know, my mother had invited Kiss to my bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
He loved that story, but he was a lovely guy. He and his wife started a pit bull rescue, and I think I alluded toward it during one of the shows back in the early summer months, certainly earlier this year, that someone near and dear to us had unfortunately befallen early onset dementia, and that indeed was Scott. And we lost him several weeks ago, and it's been... Again, in a time when things have been very, very difficult to try and comprehend emotionally, that has been a very tough loss as well. So my heart goes out to his wife and his family and his former bandmates across the boards, every bandmate that he had. And it's a personal loss. So, you know, hopefully the music of both the Dictators and the Delords will never be overlooked or forgotten.
Excellent. Well, you've given me my homework for the week, so thanks. I'm going to go back and look through a lot of that music and see what I can find in there that connects with me.
Well, I'll tell you what. There are three Delords albums that are absolutely stellar. Johnny Comes Marching, based on a true story, and there's the other one. I'm trying to think. The one that's got Judas Kiss, which is probably my favorite album by them. But in any event, just go. The Delords put out a total of 5 studio albums. Just a great band.
Great band. Excellent. And we've started something, too, in the TV realm that I want to get into for just a little bit, because it's a fair rarity that I find something that was going on, because I have one of those memories, and I know you do, too. It's kind of a blessing and a curse that anything that happened any time in my life past about age 2.5 or 3, it's all still here. So I paid attention a lot, even when I was really, really young, when I was 5 or 6 years old. I remember sitting there watching the Watergate hearings with my dad. You know, we watched that stuff on TV.
And he did not do it.
And he explained it all to me. But, you know, things like that in the Manson family. And, I mean, all this bizarre stuff. Jonestown, the Guyana tragedy, the movie that was made out of the Jonestown tragedy, aired on TV before we left Buffalo. And I remember sitting there with my sister, which means I must have been 8 or younger, watching that happen on TV and learning about all of that. So when... last week, Friday, I was sitting there watching the CBS Early Show, which I never do, and they were talking about this thing that was on Paramount Plus called Born in Synanon. And it was about a girl who back then in the late 60s and early 70s was born in a cult on the West Coast called Synanon. And I had no idea what they were talking about. None. No, don't remember it. Don't have any recollection of it whatsoever.
I remember the name. I just don't remember the background or the backstories. But I do remember that and recognize that name clearly.
It started as a rehab. As a drug and alcohol rehab.
Right. That's what I remember.
And they, and slowly but surely, over the course of maybe 10 years, they shifted. And it was all a money-making scheme anyway for the guy who started the thing, which they all are. So his only deal was, how do I maintain tax-exempt status, and how do I continue to make money off of this? So he turned it from a rehab into a religion. And when he did that, everything started to shift. And it started to go in a very violent direction. It started to go in a very protectionist direction. And they started to buy their own hype of how they were. And again, it was the 70s. I mean, see if this doesn't sound like Jonestown and the Moonies and everybody else. They were going to invent the new society that was going to replace our current society. And as soon as that happened, the whole thing just went off a cliff. So it's all told through the perspective of this woman who was 6 years old in 19, I believe it was like around 1977, 78, when her father and she left the cult. As it was getting into its most violent stage, they took off. So she only remembers what a six-year-old would remember. A very fond, oh, yeah, I remember that time. I mean, that, you know, that was when I was with all of my little friends and we were all in this school together, and doesn't remember any of the craziness. So when she started to discover and go back and look into, I think it's fascinating the way they did this. When she started to go back and look into it, she realized what it was. And she's coming slowly to that realization through the course of this documentary. And even in the documentary, it starts us, the viewers, thinking this is a very wholesome thing, and I don't understand how this goes wrong. So we're kind of learning along with her, as she's now an adult, what it was that her childhood was really all about. We're not through it yet. We're about halfway through this documentary series. And again, it's called Born in Synanon. It's on Paramount Plus, and it has been a great, because it starts you not knowing how bad things get. It does move a little slowly in the beginning, but now that it's all starting to break open, the show is absolutely spectacular. It's one not to be missed.
Two things. One, you do the streaming thing, right?
Exclusively,
yeah. Do you have like a Fire Stick or something?
No, it's all through the TV. I mean, we have most of like our local channels and all of that stuff. That all comes through Hulu. And we pay, I mean, that's the most expensive thing that we pay for every month. It's about $70, I think. And then everything else is just the regular streaming services. Amazon, which we get because we're Amazon Prime members. And Paramount Plus and Apple TV, and there's a whole slew of them.
Because I finally bought a Fire Stick. It's arriving tomorrow. And it's mainly because Diddy TV, which is that Americana channel.
Yeah.
That's what they're based on. And since they haven't had, and I actually wrote to them to ask them, are we going to see any more of your product on Circle TV? And they said, we're still trying to work out deals, but you know, I figured, you know, I'll just get the stick, and then I can watch whatever comes on when it comes on. So I just want to see how that works, and I wanted to, you know, get an opinion. What you're saying about memory, and I can actually remember my earliest TV memory was the Late Show theme on CBS, you know, the syncopated clocks. That is my earliest memory, and I also remember seeing the Jefferson Airplane on the Ed Sullivan Show and being scared by them. They were doing Crown of Creation, and that just freaked me out.
All right. Yeah, I'll bet.
Weirdly enough, yesterday in the car, in the conversation, we turned on the radio and we had it on 60s on 6, and Love is Blue by Paul Moriart came on, which is still an all-time favorite from when I was 3, which is when it came out. And Liz said something about having seen the video or the performance of it on the Ed Sullivan Show on YouTube. And I just stopped her and I said, and let me guess, he was wearing like a ruffled feathered, you know, ruffled front shirt and like a brocade maroon colored jacket, and he's playing a spinet piano. And she's like, how did you know that? I was like, because I saw it on the Ed Sullivan Show. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can remember all of that.
Yeah. You
know, I remember seeing CCR on Ed Sullivan. You know, it's a funny and weird thing. TV memories do last with you.
Oh yeah. You know? I remember the very first time that I ever watched The Wizard of Oz. And it was one of the Hallmark Hall of Fame holiday presentations. I must have been younger than four, because the house where we were watching it is the first house that I ever lived in. Actually, the second house I ever lived in. The first one we moved away from when I was about 9 months old. But the first house that I remember. And I remember my sister and my mom in the kitchen, where you could see through to where the TV was. You could see from the kitchen through to the living room where the TV was.
Sure.
And Dad and I were sitting on the couch watching Wizard of Oz while my mom and my sister made Christmas cookies. It's still there. Watching Sesame Street with my little friend Donnie from down the street. It's still there, you know? It is funny how that stuff stays with you.
Yeah, like I said, I'm going to be 59 in a couple of weeks, but I can remember things from when I was 3 years old. I mean, yes, it's sporadic at times, but, you know, at least it stays with you, you know?
It's mostly Polaroids. It's flashes. It's pictures. Yeah, it's not movies yet.
Right. I mean, I have the clearer memories. I think the clarity that I have as far as my mind goes, it goes back maybe to 78, 79 is like where it's, I guess, almost like watching the movie of your own life. You know, that's basically the best way to look at it. You know, it's funny. I just had a thought that I wanted to kind of transition from the TV thing into, but speaking of new things that we've seen and you know, time and memory and period pieces, I don't know if you've seen it yet. We've been to the movies now twice. We saw Killers of the Flower Moon, which was very good, but a little long and a little rushed at the very end. It may have needed to have been actually longer than what it was to really get it right. That was good, but my favorite movie this year by far has been The Holdovers. And that, if you have not seen it yet, do it. I think it's streaming now, actually, but Paul Giamatti just knocks it right out of the park. If he is not nominated, let alone win an Oscar for this, it is a crime. It is a terrific movie. It is an absolute masterpiece of a period piece where it was another one of those, got every little detail and element right. It's supposed to take place at the end of 1970 going into 1971, and everybody and everything looks like it. Done to a T, but the story is smart. It is funny. It's engaging. It's emotional, too. And you can't help but embrace all of the characters, good and bad, you know? It is just so well done because this movie stayed away from all pretensions and cliches that it could have gone into and all the typical tropes that movies now tend to go into.
Good.
Even though you're trying to affect a period piece, they stayed away from all of it. And it was really good. And there's a young man, and I don't know his name. He's the lead alongside of Giamatti. And this is his first movie. And you'd never know it because he's a natural. The Holdovers is definitely movie of the year as far as I am concerned.
We saw the trailer for it when we went to see Oppenheimer. And
that was, yeah. That
and,
was
and when the trailer ended, Jen and I looked at each other, and it was one of those Jinx, you owe me a Coke moments, because we looked at each other and went, we need to see that.
Yep. Yep. Same thing. The exact same thing. And it was the best thing about it was that, like, did you ever get to see Mystic Pizza?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Like Mystic Pizza, it's that kind of a warm, embracing, coming-of-age story. And the fact that they got the settings right, even right down to the actual quality of the film. You're watching this with the credits and everything where it looks exactly like it was shot in 1970, 71. It looks crappy like an old movie, like it's supposed to. But I was going to say, memory and TV and everything, one of the first movies I ever was taken to, it may have been the very first, no, it's probably the second movie I was taken to, but yeah, it was the second movie. A Boy Named Charlie Brown, 1969, in the theater, the Marlboro Theater on, I believe it was, Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And I guess I was 4 years old, and of course, you know, it was peanuts. So, you know, my family took me to see it. I hadn't seen it since 1969. Lo and behold, last Sunday morning it was on. And I didn't even look to see what was on afterwards. And I said to Liz, you know, it's funny, they're showing a boy named Charlie Brown. I said, you know, wouldn't it be great if they're doing a Peanuts marathon and Snoopy Come Home was on afterwards? Because I haven't seen that.
Snoopy. Come home.
Or no dogs allowed.
Yes.
And I said to him, if they'd only just show Snoopy Come Home, and sure enough, right afterwards. So it was absolutely, I felt like a kid again, you know. When it comes to Peanuts, I will stop everything.
Oh, yeah. You know?
I don't care that I'm not a Christian. I don't care how many times I've seen it since 1965, because it came on the first year that I was on the planet. I will always stop everything to watch a Charlie Brown Christmas.
Of
that
course.
That is the one Christmas special that will make me cry every time. It is still the most warming and touching thing I've ever known as far as Christmas goes. I actually bought it because, you know, of course, the whole Apple buying it and taking it off the air, which is just an obscenity in my book. Yeah. The same way they did the Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown and Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. I want to have it for the duration of my life. But, you know, Charlie Brown, I even have the Charlie Brown Christmas soundtrack album, you know. You do know this part, you know, the do 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 do.
Yeah, Linus and Lucy.
Thank you. That's all. You're the only other person that knows that. Everybody, oh, that's the Charlie Brown theme. No, it is not. It is called Linus and Lucy.
Yeah. So, well, my first movie experiences were Neil Simon's Murder by Death, which terrified me because I didn't understand that it was a comedy. I was too young. I was
with
Peter Sellers.
Capote.
Yes. Yeah.
And
Truman Capote.
Nancy Walker turned out to be Truman Capote in the end, or
yes.
The other way around. Yeah. No.
And David Niven is in it, and Peter Sellers, and oh God, the cast
James
is Coco, unbelievable.
Right?
Yes. Right.
What's scary is you saw these movies as a child. I was already about a decade old. It's like when you were talking about watching the Watergate hearings, which I really love.
Uh-huh.
Out. I've been through it enough. I was nine.
But exactly. Right. So yeah, because you're 5 years older than me. And the other one was a double feature that I went to also with my sister, because she was the one who took me to see Murder by Death. But Dad took me to a lot of movies back then as well. We saw Damnation Alley on the big screen. We saw Silent Movie on the big screen.
Was Damnation Alley the other Sense-A-Round film?
No. Sense-A-Round.
Midway?
Midway. Earthquake.
And the roller coaster thing.
Yeah, and I don't remember the name of it, but yes, you're right.
Was it Roller Coaster?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was. It was just called Roller Coaster. Those were the three.
Like maybe three? Okay.
Yeah. But the other one that I went to with my sister was a double feature, both animated, of Puff the Magic Dragon and Harry Nilsson's The Point.
Now, here's the thing. I saw The Point when it was on TV.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
Do you remember the song Me and My Arrow?
Of course.
Which became a hit, obviously.
And it was also used on
the Plymouth Arrow.
And a TV commercial for Arrow shirts. They used
really?
It too. Yeah.
Funny, because I still buy Arrow shirts. I still buy my mainstays, Arrow and Van Usen, because you can't get Banlon anymore.
Banlon, oh God. Oh, too much. All right. Well, that's a beautiful thing, my friend. You know, as we draw this one to a close, as you mentioned, I mean, you know, when it comes to the holiday programming, it's Charlie Brown and nothing else. But is there a choice 1A for you? Is there anything that you try to make it a point to watch?
Charlie Brown Christmas, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which was on either
the Rankin Bass stuff,
last night or two nights ago. Right now, the ultimate Christmas movie is on. The Sound of Music is on.
Yeah.
You know? Out in the hills with a lonely guardian.
If you would ask me if we would yodel in this edition of the show, I would have said not on your life. And yet here we are.
It's Christmas. So we can do whatever the fuck we want.
Well, I hope you had a wonderful Hanukkah.
Well, first of all, John, let me just say to you, Happy Hanukkah. And second of all, Merry Christmas. And if that pisses anybody off, fuck you.
Exactly.
That's what I have to say, because I am not going to sit here and allow people to dictate to me whether or not I can wish somebody a Merry Christmas or a Happy Hanukkah or whatever, or delineate, you know, because of, well, you're not a, you know, you're not Christian, so why would you, you know, you should be offended by somebody saying Merry Christmas. No, I'm not offended if somebody says Merry Christmas. It's a nice thing that somebody says to me.
Nobody is.
Somebody says to me, have a blessed day. Do you think I'm going to freak out on them because they're giving me something positive?
You know, we've talked about this before. December 25th is Christmas Day. Whether you and I observe it or not, it's Christmas Day. So if somebody wishes me a happy Christmas or a Merry Christmas, what they're saying to me is, I hope December 25th is a nice day for you. Thank you.
Right. It's the whole point of it's a festive season. But the world now has shifted to where they want everyone to be angry at everybody else. And because they're just such miserable bastards about every useless element of their meaningless lives, they want to go out and piss on everybody else's charcoals.
And
I don't think I'm sounding like Scrooge here.
No.
I'm being just the opposite, because, look, if they're so miserable, then let them die and do it now and get the surplus population. Decrease the surplus population. I'm sick and tired of it. Oh, wait, there's one more. Magoo's Christmas Carol. How can you forget that? Oh, my God. That's a criminal act for forgetting.
And I'll tell you what, as far as the Christmas Carol goes, it goes Magoo first with me. The second one on the list is the one that almost nobody saw. The American.
Don't say the one with Henry Winkler.
Henry Winkler.
Holy shit. Wow. The fact that I. Wow.
Actually,
we do know each other all too well.
That's not entirely true. I would put the Muppet Christmas Carol second, and then the Henry Winkler one, the American Christmas Carol right after that, that nobody remembers except for the two of us. It's such a great story. It's so incredibly timeless. And the fact that all three of those were able to find different things in it. And I will add one more as fourth on the list. And that's the episode of WKRP in Cincinnati when they did A Christmas Carol. And of course, who was the ghost of Christmas present? Venus Flytrap. I rest my case.
You know, you go back, all I have to do is say two words and it sums up everything about the whole Christmas season and Christmas Carol. Razzleberry fucking dressing. Okay?
Yes.
Some waffle jelly cakes, perhaps a slice. But could we have a Christmas tree and on this tree some pudding, some razzleberry dressing once or twice, you know? And on this tree a star made of shiny Christmas gold, a candle in a jar of razzleberry dressing.
Have yourself a great week.
First of all, let me just say to you, John, seriously, happy Hanukkah to you. Merry Christmas to you and Jen, to the entire family. Have a wonderful, wonderful holiday. We will talk about music on our next show, which will be after my next prostate exam in January, after my 59th birthday as well, and after your follow-up with the doctors. But we will reconvene shortly and do this. Have a wonderful, happy, healthy holiday and a wonderful, beautiful new year.
You do the same, and we're looking forward to also those stories about that brand new kitten, because I can't wait.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, my friend, that's all I can say. You know, hopefully by the next time we convene, she'll be sitting next to me.
Much love, brother.
All right, you too, and to all of you listening, thank you all for listening to us for the whole year, as you've done for the last six. Thank you for putting up with our, you know, gaps in time. Most importantly, just thank you for listening, taking part, sharing your thoughts on the shows, and for being such great people. And we love you and appreciate you. God bless. Have wonderful, happy, healthy holidays to all of you and your families. And we will talk to you in 2024.